Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hi, I'm Phil Craig.
And I'm Andrew Loney.
And together we aim to bring you the most scandalous stories and some of the most scandalous people in history. So thanks for joining us here on the Scandalmongers podcast.
Andrew, you are a fashion icon. Did you know that?
I did. I put on my blue shirt specially. Freshly pressed.
That's the first time we've ever had a comment about Andrew's clothes, and he's extremely pleased with himself.
I am. Well, apart from my jumpers.
Maybe we should, once we've sold enough mugs, have some kind of range of leisure wear for elderly gentlemen.
Yes, 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 in smoking extra large jackets, sizes.
Slippers.
Yes, why not? Are you feeling scandalous as you put your slippers on?
Very true, very true. Well, the Nazi program, which has only been up 2 days, is doing really well.
It's been
appearing in the, it was quite funny. You know, we sometimes appear in the charts in various slightly unlikely places. This week we've...
South America?
Well, Ireland, not unlikely. We've been there before. Greece, not unlikely. Argentina. I'm not making this up. We have people in Argentina listening to shows about the Nazis.
Well, I'm very keen to do a program on whether about Nazis fleeing to South America. In fact, I have an author who, and this is going to be controversial, argues that quite senior Nazi leaders got there. There was a submarine that they've been excavating. Mm. And that may really help us in Argentina in terms of our ratings.
Very, 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 very old men with extremely dodgy backgrounds. Well, actually, it's funny because I did a couple of TikToks, as I do, and one of them about the program last week, which was about Rudolf Hess, really took off. And I don't think anybody moderates TikTok. And some of the comments are really scary. And you click on them and you see these people got literal swastikas in their bios. So I'm afraid to say that's who've been...
We've been broadening our listenership. Well, yes. In publishing, there are only three subjects that sell: Tudors, Royals, and Nazis. And that's what we're finding with our podcast, really.
Nazi Tudors next, yes. We've had some lovely comments, actually. We often mention the ones on YouTube because they're easy for us to see. We've had some lovely comments from Apple as well. Shall I read you a few?
Yes, do. I always like hearing praise.
Ah, I know you do. And actually, what I now need to do is find them. So where did I put them? That's a good question. I think we emailed each other about this early, didn't we, Andrew?
You did.
So we spend most of the time comparing comments. Oh, here we are. Great stories and great conversations. I really enjoyed these guys, says Aaron from America, another American here. I love this podcast. It's a must listen. The two guys are fantastic. A vast array of subjects. It's all historical and right up my alley. And a fascinating listen. That's Obdurate 42. A must listen also. From who's this chap? Text Goon, also in America. You men are peerless purveyors of the expose. Isn't that nice?
Oh, nice. Yes. Well, I think that's one of our little USPs, really.
Well, we enjoy it. And then actually, it is the end of the month. So, do you want to tell our audience who's getting the mug, because now we have a free mug to give away for the best comment of the month. And we chose
well, one. Yes. I mean, I chose it myself, but you agree, didn't you, that it was the best?
Because guess what? It's praise for Andrew.
It's actually not even for the podcast, it was something else. I've just got to look it up now.
I've got it here, Andrew.
You've got it here.
Jesse4954. If you're listening, Jesse, you've won a mug. Please get in touch. Rachel Marks, who got last month's mug. You should have it by now, Rachel. I hope you do. Please send us a photograph when you get it. That's Illinois, I think Rachel's from. Anyway, Jesse, this is what you wrote. Dear Andrew, you were brilliant on the Windsors programme on Channel 5, which was educational and offered a new perspective and contained footage I had not seen before. It is a delight to be able to listen to your scandalmonger show on a Sunday afternoon. When are you going to get a super thanks button? She asks.
Now. Yes, well, I think we should definitely have a super thanks button. And if you want to get a mug, just feel free to say more things like that. And easiest, quickest way to our hearts is flattery.
Indeed. Well, no, the super thanks button, we are actually investigating it because we thought maybe it's about time. So watch out for news about that maybe next week. The other bit of news is we are going back to one a week. I know a lot of people have enjoyed two, but I've delivered my book, I just can't do any more than one a week. I'm sorry.
But we've got lots and lots of wonderful things banked up. So, I mean, we could easily go back to two a week when things are a little quieter for you, and indeed for me too.
Well, people can probably tell that Andrew and I don't always necessarily agree on everything. So what else? Yes. Oh, well, we've got a very packed show, so we shouldn't ramble on too much. And the subject of the show, which we haven't even mentioned yet, is sport, a subject of which Andrew knows absolutely nothing.
Yeah, it hasn't stopped me commenting, though, in the programme, I hope.
No. Well, later on we're going to hear about a snooker scandal, which is kind of a hair-raising story. But first, my football team, Manchester United. Do you want to explain who's going to talk to us and why, Andrew?
Yes, I mean, we're talking to Chris Blackhurst, who's a former editor of the Independent newspaper here in Britain, was on the Sunday Times Insight team, which was their sort of journalistic investigative team. And he's had a very distinguished journalistic career. He's also worked in public relations on crisis management. So he's going to talk to us a little bit about reputation management, I think, as part of this. But he's written two very good books, one which I think he's going to talk about in a future programme, and this is the sort of way that HSBC, the bank, was involved with the drug cartels. But today he's going to talk to us about how the Glazer family took over Manchester United and the finances of football, which are pretty scandalous. I'm looking forward to learning a little bit about a subject I don't know much about.
Well, I've been supporting Manchester United since I was 6 years old. Should be 1966. I've seen them rise, and fall again. But they're still probably the most popular football team in the world. Sorry, Americans, we do call it football, not that thing that you do with people running around wearing helmets. Shall we get on to Chris?
I think we should.
Shall I sing us in? Glory, glory, Man United. Glory. Okay, that's enough. See you soon.
Well, I'm delighted to have another of my heroes in tradition of Richard Norton Taylor and Michael Crick, Chris Blackhurst, a former editor of The Independent, the author of several acclaimed books, including one on Manchester United, which I think we're going to talk about today, and was voted by PR Week as one of the top 10 reputational crisis managers. So I hope we can maybe touch on that and you can give some advice to members
we might
of
need
the
your
family
help.
And elsewhere for free.
I'll do my best.
And Chris is an old friend going back many years to a contemporary of ours at university. So,
sorry, I did forget this, so I'm going to put it on.
So, thank you so much for talking to us. I mean, Phil, I think, is going to do quite a lot of the chatting because he's a United fan. But so do you want to sort of kick off, Phil, with some details about Chris's book, which we'll be promoting at the end of the podcast?
Yeah, just tell me when it'll end. When will we start winning again? And remember when we win the European Champions League again? That's all. I just need to know a timeline. Will it be within the rest of my life?
The problem with you lot, the problem with Manchester United fans, is a profound sense of entitlement. You had some very good years under Alex Ferguson and before that under Matt Busby. You tend to forget the years in between. As a Fulham season ticket holder, all I can say is welcome to the club. But you know, success is not a given. You can spend as much money as you want, by the way, and you still won't succeed. So, saying all that, of course, United's got huge potential. It's got the romance and everything. I think I would temper your questions slightly and say, not when will we win the European Champions League again, but when will we be properly challenging for the Champions League, which I think is a more realistic prospect. And then from that, you might win. I mean, so I would say, if Jim Ratcliffe can get everything together and take over the football side and persuade top players to want to join the club, if he can reinvent the academy, everyone forgets that the great team of Ferguson's day was the class of 92.
That's right.
The class of 92 were kids. I mean, David Beckham, Ryan Giggs, Paul Scholes, Nicky Butt, the Neville brothers, they were kids and they came through the academy. The academy's been allowed to fall by the wayside. There are signs of recovery now. You're going to have to be patient.
I mean, the theme of today's podcast is scandal in sport. I mean, your book is very much about the financing of football and what the Glazers did there, which fascinates me as a sort of non-sports fan. I mean, it's all really about how sport has been sort of infected by corruption in some ways.
Yeah. I mean, I would look, it's not a football book. It's about football. It isn't written for football people. It certainly isn't written for devotees of Manchester United. It really is a book about money and power. And what you've got is you've got this fantastic money-making machine, which is the Premier League, and European TV football rights, and people piling in order to gain access to that. And that the problem that is created is that of the Premiership clubs at the moment, 14 of them are owned by Americans. And the problem with that is that Americans back in their homeland don't do relegation. If you're a franchise owner in basketball, baseball, American football, ice hockey, you own the franchise, you are not going to get relegated. Nothing will relegate you. It's guaranteed. Your membership is guaranteed. And if you're spending north of £1 billion, and in the case of Manchester United, £5 billion, and Chelsea was over £3 billion, you don't want to spend all that money and face the prospect of being relegated or not being in the top tier of European football where the TV rights are astronomical.
How do you regulate this? I mean, how do you ensure that it's a little bit more of a level playing field?
Well, that's a very tricky prospect, a tricky thing. I mean, there's a lot of pressure on the government right now to regulate, but of course, it's not football isn't just a British game. In Spain and Italy, there's some of their top clubs, and in France, some of their top clubs are very hard up. And they would welcome being part of the European Super League. And that was the project, which I'm sure you remember, where club owners, led by the Glazers at Manchester United, got together and devised the plan so that they would all play each other and not be relegated and share the TV rights. Now, the problem for that is that the romance in football dies at that point. I go and watch Fulham. I'm not absolutely diehard. Cut me open. I'm not going to flow Fulham FC or anything like that. But the romance in watching Fulham is that they too can do it, that they might get to the very top.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, the huge success of that Wrexham series in the United States is based on the fact that, and this was a complete revelation to many of the audience, that you can take a team from a small town and it can rise and rise and rise. And they just don't have that, as you say, in their own franchise-based sports.
I mean, it wasn't that long ago that Leicester City won the Premiership. In the book, I talk about the old model of football ownership was the local boy done good. And it was the local businessman who'd made a lot of money in whatever trade it was, buying the football club where he used to go as a boy. That was the tradition. And that's been repeated all over Britain, all over the world. Local businessman buys football club. The last person, though, and this is indicative, 1995, Jack Walker, the steel baron, bought Blackburn Rovers, invested a huge amount of his personal fortune in Blackburn Rovers. If you watch the end of the season when Blackburn Rovers win the Premiership with Alan Shearer and Chris Sutton, superstar players. Jack Walker, the tears are pouring down his face. It is a hugely emotional moment. Even now, I can remember watching it and I still see it. And you can watch it on YouTube. He's crying his eyes out. And it meant so much to him. The interesting thing is that was 1995. 1996 was the year that Rupert Murdoch changed football forever by putting the Sky offer for TV rights just went through the roof. And that changed. And that suddenly woke everyone up to the fact that, I mean, look, historically, nobody made money in football. I mean, the favourite saying was, you know, you want to lose a billion or lose a million, buy a football club. And, you know, nobody made money. Now they're making fortunes.
So why is the Glazers, though, just before we forget about Man United?
I was going to say, why are they so unpopular?
Why what, sorry?
Sorry, the Glazers so unpopular with the fans.
They're unpopular. When you analyse it and get down to it with the fans, as I did for the book, the fan groups, when you really get down to the nitty-gritty, and there's some bad language, I'll try and keep that out, but they, you know, it was repeated to me several times. They don't give, you know, they don't care, they don't give a shit. They don't go to them. I mean, owners are meant to, or not meant to, the football fans appreciate it if the owners are there, if they're watching their team. I went to Fulham, Mohamed Al Fayed would come on the pitch before the match, twirl a scarf around and sing a daft song about, the song would go, "We're not Barcelona, we're not Real Madrid, we are Fulham." I mean, ridiculous song. The truth was, a lot of the fans would quite like to be Real Madrid or Barcelona. Thank you, Mohamed. But at least he was there, and he was there in spirit. The problem with the Glazers is they never went. They never showed their faces. Famously, it's in the book, Malcolm Glazer, the patriarch of the family, said, I think it's 34 words about buying Manchester United and what it meant to him. Right. And he used the word franchise twice, and it was terrible. And
how much money have they made from the club? Because the fans think they've made a fortune.
They have made a fortune. That's why it's called the world's biggest cash machine, which is an adaptation slightly of a quote from Paul Parker, the former player, where he talks about this. But the look, they've sold a quarter of the club to Jim Ratcliffe for $1.25 billion. Well, okay, do the maths. But there's another $3.75 billion there. They, over the years, have taken out hundreds of millions in dividends and consultancy payments to themselves. And the other point is that they didn't put any of their own money in.
Mm.
And we now think that, I mean, at the time it was said that they bought the club for 800 million, give or take. 600 million was from hedge funds in New York on very high punitive rates of interest. And that debt was secured and put on the club. It wasn't put on the Glazers. So the Glazers borrowed the money, but transferred the debt went to the club. So Manchester United went from being a profitable, debt-free club to having the biggest debts in football. 200 million came from the Glazers, but that was borrowed against... they own lots of shopping malls across America. And I mean, we're not talking glamorous malls. These aren't Westfields or anything like that. These are suburban, out-of-town...
Low-rise
strips, yeah. Really. Yeah, strips with car parks. And they mortgaged against those. So in terms of their actual own cash, they didn't put any in at all. And they've walked away, you know, if the valuation is correct. And by the way, there are lots of people who say it's too low. Hard as that seems, the way football is changing, in the summer they tested micro cameras on players. These are literally dots. I mean, you wouldn't even know it. You don't know it's there. It's on your shirt. It's as high on the neckline as you can get it, because that's obviously where your face is. And it enables the viewer can be Ronaldo. The viewer can be the referee. The viewer can be the goalkeeper. They have to pay for it. But for 90 minutes, you watch the game and play the game through their eyes as if you're the player.
Yes.
Now, that could transform football.
I did not know that. That sounds amazing.
There are people who say United is the biggest club in the world. It's got the biggest following. It's number one on TikTok. Number one in all forms of social media. I mean, United themselves give a crazy figure for their fan base. When the Glazers bought the club, they did some research and they got to 333 million. And that raised eyebrows. I mean, that's a lot of people. Well, in the 18th, apparently now... Well, that's one in seven of the world's population. But, you know, it could be. I mean, China, Asia, India, I mean, you know, Southeast Asia, there is only one club, and it's Manchester United.
So, I don't understand how you can put a debt onto one lot of people, the club, and take the profits yourself. How does that work?
How it works very simply, Andrew. You own the club. It's your club. But the debt, the money you use to borrow it, is set against the club. If you want to take the profit, you can take the profits. You're the owner.
So does this happen all in other clubs? Does it happen in other businesses?
No, it's not happened at all in football that I'm aware of. United under the Glazers became the first football club in the world to pay a dividend to its owners. No other club had ever done that. I mean, as I say, the tradition of football clubs was that you didn't buy them to make money. You bought them because you love the game and put something back. Finding clubs that actually made money, very difficult. And that's certainly not the European tradition. The European tradition, you know, they're not there to make money. They're almost charities. And it was the first club in the world to pay a dividend. And that's what they did.
So what happened to Manchester City? Why is that different there? What, is that a very different model that the people that bought Man City, they didn't really intend to take money out of it?
They're not looking for a return. I mean, Sheikh Mansour doesn't need to... it needs to wash its face. It needs to stay within the financial fair play rules. but he's not looking to make a profit. Abramovich wasn't looking to make a profit. Mohammed Fayed wasn't looking to make a profit. I mean, you own a football club because high profile, PR, you want to put something back. But of course, that's changed with the Glazers. I mean, it give you an idea of what the Glazers are like. Malcolm Glazer. Malcolm Glazer was the son of the Lithuanian, almost Orthodox Jews. Glazer, they settled in Rochester County in New York. Malcolm Glazer is the son of a watch repairer and jeweler. His father died when he was 15, and he took over the... He effectively left school and went into business with his mother. Quite an interesting observation there. I can think of several businessmen, very well-known businessmen, including Philip Green, where exactly the same thing happened. Their father dies young, and they go into business at a very young age. And he specialized in ruthless deals, buying crap, basically, running it down, firing people, selling things. I mean, he became known, I mean, on Wall Street, he was not taken at all. So he's a sort of, you know, you can always try Malcolm Glazer. If you tried everyone else and they're not interested, try Malcolm Glazer. But I'll give you a flavour of the guy. Two little stories are in the book. One was that in 1992, in America, if you really want to make it in business at a certain level as an entrepreneur, you have to own a franchise in one of the major sports, whether ice hockey, baseball, basketball, or football. And they are cash cows. If you can afford one and get one, and as I say, you're not going to be relegated, wow, you know, it's there. And 1992, he wasn't bothered which sport it was, but he wanted, as it happened, he wanted the football franchise for Baltimore. He had no connection with Baltimore. He gave an interview. It's the only interview he's ever given, any detailed interview. 1992, he gave an interview to the Baltimore, I think it's the Sun it's called, and bearing in mind, he wanted to win hearts and minds in Baltimore. I mean, this is meant to be a PR job. And he had his young son, Joel, sitting alongside him. And he told the reporter that his plan was to get the franchise for football for Baltimore, but then make the team play in three other cities.
Oh, gosh.
And only a quarter of the matches would take place in Baltimore because it would become America's team. And the reporter looked aghast and couldn't understand this concept. I mean, we're not talking community here. We're not talking, local city or local. None of that entered Malcolm Glazer's head. He wanted a very commercial America's team. That's one story. The second story is that when his mother died, Malcolm was one of six children, and the mother left all the money, and it was quite a bit of money by then, several millions. She left the money to be divided six ways between the children. Malcolm said, no. He had earned that money with the mother. It was his money, and his siblings were not to get a cent. There was actually a fist fight at a party where the police were called, the Glazer family party. And then after that, writs flied, and he effectively sued his siblings to stop them getting the inheritance. The case lasted 12 years. It went through three judges. It went through different sets of lawyers. It was a war of attrition. But Glazer would not back off. He would not settle. He was taped in the well of the court, saying to his lawyer, "We need to keep this going as long as possible to get the finals, get the sum down, get the inheritance down." That's the sort of guy he was.
Well, this is not filling me with confidence about my team, I have to tell you.
But isn't this inevitable? I mean, isn't this just the way that sport's going now? It's the money men who are running it. All that sense community is a thing of the past.
Yeah, I think that's very true. I think it's reflection of, as I say, it started with Murdoch and the TV rights, and it's gone on from there, and it gets bigger and bigger, and we're not at the end yet, and you know, maybe we're going to enter a system where football or all sports are in two tiers, where you've got the top game, which is played for and watched and paid for by money men. And I mean, you're seeing it in golf and tennis with the Saudis wanting to take over. You've certainly seen it in Formula One. And maybe the rest of us have to make do with some sort of not so good game, not so good players.
But maybe it's a better game. I mean, there's investment. I mean, you talk about the things on the shirts, you know, people buying in players. It may be tiered now, but doesn't it improving in some ways the quality of the sport?
I don't disagree with that. And you know, the grounds have improved. I mean, the facilities, everything around the game has improved. The problem, though, is that fundamentally sport, you know, it's that word sport. Sport isn't the same as basket weaving or painting pictures. Sport is about winning. And, you know, you want your team to win. And one of the sayings in sport or in football is it's the hope that kills us. And, you know, we go along and watch Fulham. Yeah, we meet for drinks in the Winchester House Club, which you know in Putney. A group of us meet there for a drink. We go and watch the team. The team either win or lose. Quite often they lose. We then go back to the Winchester House and spend the next hour staring into the bottom of pint glasses. And then we pick ourselves up and it's the next week. And that scenario is repeated all over Britain, all over the world. That's what football fans do. And it's the hope that kills you.
Can I ask one question about Manchester City? Obviously, they are the great rivals of Manchester United. Their owners seem to be less interested in taking money out of the club, but they have got into real trouble over the way they've been spending their money buying players. Do you have any sort of thoughts about that? What's happened there?
City have, because City set out to buy top players in one go. World superstars. City's revenues, Manchester City may be a big club, but they are nothing versus Manchester United. They're nothing, by the way, versus Liverpool. The way the fair play system works is it's a balancing act between the revenue, what's coming into the club, and how much you're spending. Well, United are able to buy top players because they've got so much coming in. But on the other hand as well, United didn't really, you know, they have bought top players, but they've not bust the bank. City sort of did. I mean, they went out and really did buy top players, and they could yet pay a price.
They actually went beyond the limits that were sort of set down by the governing body.
Yeah.
No sympathy.
Just to sort of round off, I hope another time we can talk to you about your HSBC book, but if you were advising the royal family now, what advice would you have given them?
That's a good question. I mean,
presumably they wouldn't have got into this mess if they'd been talking to you a bit sooner.
You mean the royal family?
Yeah, well, I mean, the way King Charles dealt with his illness, the way that Kate dealt with it, I think you might have some advice for Prince Andrew and Prince Harry at the same time.
Yeah. I would advise, this won't surprise you, I think I would advise obviously being more open and honest. The photograph was a disaster, the doctored photograph. Why we had to wait so long to discover that Kate had cancer, it could have been said early on. Obviously, she's got her privacy, but I think if you're a member of the royal family, a senior member of the royal family, you can't look with the Faustian pact, the sacrifice you make is you lose some of your privacy. You know, the other side of that is that while you're not saying anything, the rest of the world is, and they're speculating and writing rubbish. What amazes me is how long they sit there letting the rubbish be written without correcting it, without saying anything.
So is this is bad PR advice they're getting, or they're just ignoring the advice they're getting?
I think it's both. I think the problem with, I've had experience of this myself. I worked for the Lebedevs for 5 years, the Russian oligarchs who owned the Standard and the Independent, sorry, more than 5 years. With them and with far greater scale with the royal family, things tend to operate like a court, and clearly they do in the royal family. It's called the royal court, and in a royal court you're all jostling for position, and the people who tend to rise up tend to be the ones who agree, who go along. The ones who offer contrary advice, who challenge, tend not to be around very long. And I think there's an element of that with the royal family, that you'd have to be a brave PR, a brave communications secretary to contradict King Charles. You know that if you contradicted Prince Andrew, you'd almost certainly get your head bitten off. Where does that leave your job? And so they're surrounded by yes people. And I think that's part of the problem.
Yes, that's certainly what I saw with Andrew. I mean, those who challenged him in his naval career basically were shifted to the side, and those who went along with it got promoted of his superior officers. Yeah. How about Harry? I mean, suing the papers doesn't seem to be a good way of getting the press on your side.
No, I think with Harry, I think there's the legacy of Diana and how she died, the feeling that she was driven to her death by the press. And I think for him, you can see it. It's intensely personal. It's like an act of revenge. He can never forgive the press for what happened. That drives him and motivates him. And he's driven on as well by his wife, who clearly shares the same view. You know, for them, it's become a cause. It's a crusade, but it's very personal.
And I mean, would your advice be to buy a football club to improve your reputation? not running it like the Glazers, but running it the old style.
I think if I was, somebody came to me and I don't know, and this does happen. Somebody came to me and said, "Chris, I want to raise my profile. I want to get well known. How can I do it? I want people to like me." Well, actually, you put a finger on it. Buying a football club isn't a bad answer. Buying a Premiership club is different because they cost a fortune. But buying a first or second division club like the Hollywood actors did with Wrexham, they're loving it. They've got, the people of Wrexham love them. They're applauded everywhere they go. They're having a great time. They're having a ball. And, you know, buy a football club. Well, by the way, the valuations fall off a cliff once you get outside the Premiership. So, you know, you can pick up a football club for next to nothing.
So, Andrew, should we buy a club, Andrew?
Succession. I mean, isn't that what they do? They buy a club and they just don't quite know what the club is. And they go to one match and that's about it.
Yeah. I'm from Cumbria. My hometown's Barrow-in-Furness. And my home team was bought by a guy who was at my school. He was in the book. He's a friend of mine. I didn't know him at school, but I got to know him later. He made a lot of money in America in mobile phones. And he came back and bought, in a moment of madness, as he admits, probably drunk, he agreed to buy Barrow Football Club for £3 million. And he was regarded immediately as a hero. The problem was that the fans, it comes back to the very first question you asked me, the fans wanted to know, when are we going to get Neymar? You know, the top player in the world. That's all they care about. They care about, when are we going to win?
All true.
He bought the club. He was prepared to share with the local council the cost of a new stadium. The local council, who were Labour council, said, "You're rich, you pay for it." As he said to me recently, it was his worst nightmare, the whole thing.
So, Phil, maybe we won't buy a club. I think we might just find something else.
We've got some
mugs. That's much better.
I think we should. There's a very small team. There must be a team you support. Do you actually support a team? Do you do sport, Andrew?
No.
No.
No. I'm going to watch the boat race. That's about it.
That's more your speed, I think.
Buy a small team somewhere somewhere nice and sleepy. Their expectations aren't very high. It wouldn't cost you that much money. You might lose a bit, but it wouldn't be that much. Nothing wrong with that.
And what's the best and worst crisis management advice you've given?
The best crisis management I give to people, look, a lot of crisis management is common sense. Most people don't understand how the press work, how journalists think, because I was and still am a journalist for 40 years. I know sadly how they think and how twisted their minds are. only ever say what you know to be true. You can have a crisis and you can make it worse by saying something that isn't true. I mean, it's a well-known phrase, it's the cover-up that's worse. It doesn't have to be a cover-up. It could be,
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I was advising an aviation company. One of their products crashed. They immediately, the CEO wanted to put out a press release saying it was pilot error. I said, "Do you know that?" And he said, "Well, it was in the mountains. It was in fog. It must have been." I said, "No. Do you actually know it? to be true. Well, of course not. It's only just crashed. And it turned out he didn't. I said, don't put it out. Don't say pilot error. He didn't, fortunately. And it then turned out it was a mechanical failure.
Yes. It's actually like the Monmouth Qantar story we were talking about with Richard Norton Taylor last week.
Yeah, I mean, it's I'm trying to think the worst advice. I don't know. There was somebody I advised to give an interview. It wasn't as bad as Prince Andrew's, but it wasn't far off.
Right. Well, that's not your fault.
No. But you say to people, put it all out there, that, you know, and even what I've just said, where you say, stick to the truth. You can't go, you know, if you stick to the truth, tell them what, you know, only what you know. Unfortunately, he said far too much. And, the press had him. But
so never complain, never explain in some ways.
Yeah. Half the time you're dealing with people who, it's very hard to explain in the sense that the world has changed. And, you know, if you're very high profile, famous, and something goes wrong today, the world crashes in on you in an amazing fashion. I mean, you know, you're viral on social media. You're everywhere. Your name is mud. As we speak, journalists are looking up your Facebook entries, contacting your old school friends, your old girlfriends, your own boyfriends. I mean, they're pouring over your social media, and you've got demands for, you know. If you're famous and you're used to giving interviews and now you won't give interviews, well, that causes issues as well. You know, what are you hiding? And it's very, very difficult, very stressful.
Because, again, when you look at the post office scandal, I mean, that took a long time to come out, even though clearly Price and I were writing about it. It needed a TV drama. I mean, they stalled it. They, you know, just played a straight bat. And now we have the disclosures of that they knew exactly what was going on. I mean, how would you advise them at this stage? Basically, pay the compensation and move to a monastery.
The post office, without question, the compensation should be paid immediately or as quickly as possible. I mean, pay it and move on, and say sorry and say sorry loudly and mean it. One of the issues we have now is that cameras don't lie. They can tell now if somebody's not, if it's unconvincing. I mean, say sorry, mean it, pay them and move on. Don't come out with trite statements saying we're learning the lessons. I mean, nobody believes all of that stuff, but that's what they should be doing.
And does it need some victims? Not victims, sorry, it needs some sacrificial lambs to get a prison.
Well, if it's possible to make a case, well then yes. I would be very careful about saying that there will be sacrificial lambs, and then it turns out that you can't bring a case. Society demands heads on plates. They're not always available. The post office happened a long time ago. If it's possible to find people who can be, as it were, brought to justice, then so be it. But it doesn't need it, no.
And I mean, the hacking case, I mean, again, Harry has Rebecca Brooks and Piers Morgan in his sights. What's going to happen there?
I don't know about Rebecca. She's previously been charged and, you know, was acquitted. I don't know. I think they'd be wary of going near her again. I think with Piers Morgan, there are questions. There are stories about Piers Morgan showing how hacking works and things like that. His statements are very, very carefully written. You have to read, they are very, very careful about what he's saying. He could be, I just don't know. I don't know.
Gosh. Yes. God, we've covered a lot of ground and we haven't even got on to your HSBC book.
No.
We hope you'll come back for that.
I'll happily come back.
Yeah, no, it's been terrific. No,
I'll see you down Craven Cottage.
Oh, well, where do you go?
I used to go with my son, because even though he's also a Man U fan, sorry, we used to watch the local teams because you could get tickets there.
Yeah.
And you could do a ritual handing over of one of our mugs to Chris.
I certainly could, with great pleasure. Not this one, though. I'll send you a
proper one.
All the best, Chris.
Okay.
Thanks very much. That was great. Okay, bye.
Bye.
Well, we covered a lot there. Sport, royal family.
I'm trying to work out who Chris's high-profile clients were, asking him for advice.
Yes. Yeah, no, I think he's had some pretty impressive people. Very interesting. I know a little bit more about sport now. So
we have more
sport coming. Another sort of scandal.
Yes, we do. We do. And I think we're probably not going to be buying a football team, unless it's like under-13s school team. Maybe they can sponsor them. But yes, snooker. Huge sport, but kind of quite a new sport. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why it's attracted the big scandal.
It's all about match fixing, isn't it?
Yes, it's a match fixing scandal in the wild and wacky world of snooker, which, although it's an international game, has its kind of spiritual heartland in a rather unlikely place, not far from where I grew up, in the town of Sheffield in Yorkshire, where the sort of annual world championships are held. And people flock there from all over the world to play this game. So it's Andrew and Matt, who by some distance are the youngest people I think we've had on the podcast, have been investigating this for, is it Tortoise Media?
Yes. Very good investigative website and magazine.
Yeah, so they have agreed to let us in on some of the secrets of what they found out about the wild and wacky world of snooker. Should we do it?
Let's go for it.
Well, hello. We, apart from serious microphone envy, which I'm now experiencing, looking down Andrew's microphone. Welcome, Andrew. Welcome, Matt. I think you're the youngest people we've had on this podcast, which is a good thing.
Thank you.
You've halved the average age of me and Andrew, I think. And you're very welcome.
It's not often I get described as being the young person, so I'm absolutely delighted to hear it. Thank you so much.
And we've got a real departure from what we normally talk about. We haven't really talked about sport before, so we're really interested to hear what you have to say about your investigations.
Yes, I should just, by way of introduction, this is a podcast about another podcast, which is we'll put the link in the bio of the show. Excellent program. Really interesting investigation into what I would have thought was the rather sedate, cozy world of snooker. But perhaps you can tell me why I'm wrong.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for having us on your show. Snooker, you're absolutely right to describe snooker as being serene. But last year was rocked by what Martin Ziegler in the Times called the biggest sporting scandal of the last decade. So I suppose it's kind of ripe for this particular podcast. But snooker is kind of a game that's characterized by its serenity. The stuff that in our podcast that actually got edited out, and Matt and I can talk you through how much does get taken out of a podcast like this, was the fact that they have such kind of strict dress code rules, down to how many buttons you're allowed on your waistcoats, and snooker is, if you've been, is just this quiet, incredibly serene sport, and then it gets rocked by this huge match fixing scandal, which is not actually uncommon for snooker itself. It's happened before, but our podcast looked into this huge match fixing scandal that erupted over the course of a couple of years, but eventually ended in this sporting resolution and hearing last year.
Now, I know a lot of this story is going to touch on China, where snooker is absolutely massive, something I didn't know till I came across your story. But for people who are not British, maybe we have a lot of American and Canadian listeners, is snooker a truly global game, or is it a sort of odd British game that's just become popular in China?
Matt, do you want to say?
I would say it's predominantly a British game that became popular in China. I mean, the only reason why I hesitate is, so the organization that investigated this match fixing is the, and Andrew, correct me if I'm wrong, is the World Pool Billiards Snooker Association. And the pool and billiards bit is key there, because pool and billiards are huge in America and in Canada. And it's probably the game that most of us are familiar with. If you go down to the pub, that's the thing that you're most likely to see. So snooker is, I would argue, a much more difficult version of pool. It's a much more substantially sized table, and as a result, I think it's a much slower paced game, which is probably why it's taken quite a long time for it to move beyond the UK, and it's probably one of the reasons why China has taken such a liking to it, alongside, actually, part of it is a Hong Kong influence. So in the 1980s, as a way to find common ground over Hong Kong, the Chinese government started televising snooker games, and that's where, reportedly, it started gaining interest in China.
So another unlikely part of the story is that so much of it takes place in the Yorkshire town of Sheffield, my home county, which is, you know, globally famous for this game. It's a kind of quiet post-industrial former steel town that once a year hosts this enormously important competition. So tell us how all these Chinese players came to Sheffield and why things started to unravel.
Yeah, I suppose it's one of those quirks of many sports have these things that you kind of go, oh, hang on a second, that is quite bizarre that this thing happens in this particular sport. But Sheffield is the home of snooker, or it's the spiritual home of snooker. And so if you want to be competing with the best players or training with the best players, it's most common that you're going to be moved to Sheffield. And I guess because of its rich history as a city with snooker, one thing leads to the other. And so lots of Chinese players, but not just Chinese players, lots of players from around the world come and train at the academies and the venues there. So Sheffield hosts the World Championships and has done for the last 50 or so years at the Crucible Theatre. It's a very, when we went to visit, it had pantomime on, and you can't imagine that this place will then transfer from that in a couple of months' time to where the eyes of the world of snooker will be on, because it only holds 950 odd people. There's always kind of chatter in the snooker community whether or not it will stay in Sheffield or whether or not it will stay at the Crucible Theatre, because it, for a sport that's so popular, especially around the world, it does seem incredibly small as a venue. But it is because of its history as a city, that's why so many players end up moving to Sheffield. There's academies in Sheffield as well that Chinese players are just very familiar with. And so we mentioned a couple. So the Ding Dong Hui Academy and Victoria's Academy have a high number of Chinese players that come over and train. And I guess it's that familiarity. If you're going to move away from China, you want to be around a community of people that you feel familiar with, that also are kind of like-minded in so much as they play snooker and they want to become professional. So, yeah, that's why Sheffield is the centerpiece for our podcast.
So sport, all sport attracts gambling. I think snooker in China and the Far East attracts a lot of gambling. Can you give me some sense of the scale? Because this obviously is what's going to lead us to the main event of how gambling started to affect the players.
I mean, it's enormous. It's the figures are quite staggering in terms of what we were told. Hundreds of billions of dollars and pounds over the course of a year. There's a stat that we were told that it's going to be impossible to stand up because it's all primarily in the black market. So gambling is banned in China, so it all has to happen in the black market. And the stat was that in 1 month of gambling on the black market is the same as the annual turnover of Nike. So that just kind of gives you a scale of how much money is being gambled on games. But like with many match fixing scandals, the figures that end up being given to the players end up being quite small. So we were talking about £5,000 or £6,000 for players to fix matches. But then at the higher end, where money can't be tracked in China, the figures are just absolutely vast.
So who was there? One particular player that first attracted the attention of the authorities in the sport, or was it more a kind of gradual realization that something wasn't quite right?
It was a gradual process. We start our podcast off with looking at one particular shot, and that was a shot done by a player called Chang Bin-Yu against Jamie Jones in I need to check that.
2020, actually, but, I think.
Yeah, in 2020. And he misses a shot that...
2022. I know your own story better than you.
He misses a shot that 9 times out of 10 he'd get in, but he misses it by such a distance. They're just like, hang on, that is so peculiar. Because if he goes on to pot that ball, then he would have won effectively too many frames for the fix that had been agreed. And so it's not just that. It was more suspicious betting patterns, because once betting patterns happen in the black market, they seep out into the legitimate markets, essentially. So we speak to people from a place called Sport Radar who track like hundreds of thousands of sporting fixtures over the course of a year. And they have all these betting algorithms and they can see what the markets are doing. And they spotted some suspicious patterns going on. And so and betting companies can actually flag up when they see something that they think is untoward. In my head, it was like a big red button. It's not quite like that. I think it's more like a click on the cursor. But they can kind of press a button that goes, come someone look into this, because this doesn't particularly seem quite right. So it wasn't one particular match. We frame some of the podcast around this one particular shot. But it was a series of matches. And then people investigating started to piece together, okay, this has happened. This player's been involved. This player's been involved. What's going on here? And who's essentially orchestrating this?
I
was just going to add to that, which was, so Sport Radar had monitored this over a number of matches. They then flagged to the WPBSA, the Snooker Association, their concerns. And that's where Nigel Moore, the sort of investigator for the WPBSA, gets involved. And I think the first match he checks is Aaron Hill versus Chang Yangbu. I can't remember exactly, but it was... so they got a note that there were odd betting patterns on that match with Aaron Hill. And so that's the first match that Nigel goes to investigate. And that sort of kicks out the official investigation. But as Andrew said, there'd been a gradual process before then.
I mean, great sporting people make mistakes all the time. Great goal scorers will miss open goals. You know, great sprinters will trip up and fall over. Great snooker players will miss easy shots. How were they able to prove, apart from the movement in the betting market, how were they able to get the guy to confess, assuming he did confess, that he was actually being ordered to lose a game?
Yeah, it's a really good question, because actually over the course of our investigation, I was quite surprised how much human interaction there is, actually. So something will get flagged in betting systems, and they will still have humans as spotters, essentially, in matches. And so something might get flagged before a game, and they'll say, actually, can someone go? And this will be an ex-professional, or this will be a kind of a highly skilled sports person, go to a particular game and go, yeah, that doesn't look right to me. So let's keep this kind of live as an investigation. So it's a combination of both, of suspicious betting patterns and actually looking into the evidence. I guess it's what Sir Alex Ferguson used to call the eye test. He used to go against kind of data in terms of when he signed players. He would just go, right, no, I can just see that. And I guess there's probably a similarity in terms of a snooker player will go, hang on a second, he's just potted three in a row with aplomb, and then he missed that one by that much. Mm. That's really interesting.
So this chap, Chan, I'm going to massacre this word. I apologize to any Chinese person listening. Chan Bin Yu, you mentioned, who missed the shot in 2022. Did he, in fact, confess?
That's a good question, Matt.
I don't think he did, actually, because I don't think he appeared in... if you give me 2 minutes, I'll find that.
So he stuck to his story. He just missed. But the authorities decided that this was wrong, and that was the beginning of you know, dozens of players were suspended in the end.
I don't know if he admitted to specific missing of that shot. That's what I know. He admitted to general match fixing.
Okay.
Because he's one of the players who got the reason why we know about the coercion in the sport is because of Chan Bingyu and what he told the investigators. So I think he admits it to general match fixing, but I can't specify whether he
That match was the match that he had been charged against as well. So they saw that there was a fix in place in that match, and obviously over the course of a series of match, he would have to miss quite a few shots. But that one in particular was a really interesting one, because I believe he was 3-1 down at that point. The fix was in place to lose the game 4-1. If he'd lost 3-2 or 4-2, then there's probably going to be repercussions in terms of the actual money that's been gambled. So he needed to lose that frame.
So who is behind this fix? Who was leaning on this man? Or maybe he didn't need leaning on. How did that kind of wider conspiracy unravel?
So effectively, the story at the top of the snooker tree, if we can call it that, are two players, Liang Wenbo and Li Hong, who are slightly older, more senior players. Liang Wenbo, especially more senior, and he kind of he could have had a very, very good career, and he kind of fell off slightly, and he went off the rails as well. He and Li Hong. Essentially, it was found that they were exerting pressure on young players who'd moved to Sheffield, and were putting pressure on them to get involved in the fixes. Above Li Hong and Liang Wenbo, no one really knows. So you assume that there would be some pressure from back home, that people would say, look, we can offer you X amount of money if you can convince these players to put these fixes in place. But above the actual snooker itself, that's where kind of pretty much the criminal element of it would happen. When we spoke to the snooker authorities about it, they were kind of at pains to say that, you know, we can only control what we can control. So we can ban players from the sport because they sign up to a code of conduct, etc. But anything above that is down to the police and the authorities. And I think there was a slight unwillingness in this particular instance, at least, to look beyond the actual snooker fixes, and rather whether or not there was the criminal element outside of that. So the fixes were done within the snooker playing community itself. Above that, we don't really know.
Rolling. I mean, so China, I think you mentioned one of your interviewees, the Communist Party takes sport really seriously, a bit like the old East European states used to in the Cold War. They're very proud of their sporting achievements. No doubt these men who were banned were heroes in China. So did the government make a fuss? Did they complain? Did they support their chaps, or accept that they were in the wrong?
Really interestingly, because they'd been caught and because they'd been banned by the World Snooker Authority, China took an incredibly dim view of their own conduct, and so extended some of their bans as well. So they said, effectively, no, you've kind of disgraced yourself, and you've disgraced the country's name as well. So we have seen your 18 months or 2 year ban. We're actually going to extend this further to show kind of how serious they are about match fixing and about cheating in sport. Because you're right, they are incredibly proud of their sporting achievements. And I think it kind of sends a message out to future players that this will not be tolerated.
Andrew, you're very quiet.
No, I'm just fascinated by what you're saying and how you were able to uncover this trail. I mean, how many people were involved in this, do you think?
That's the $1 million question, really, isn't it? It's
it's the multi-billion-dollar question, Matt.
So, ten players were in the end charged and banned. Two more were, I think, cleared, or certainly charges were dropped. We know there was at least one non-snooker person involved, but they were UK-based because they were the one who put pressure on Chang Bingyu. And we have strong suspicions. I'm just trying to think of how I can carefully frame it. Essentially, there was not enough evidence to say categorically one way or another, but it would not surprise me to find out there were strong links back to China, where who knows how many people are involved, if any. It could just be that this was self-contained within Sheffield in the UK and among those 10 to 13 players. But given the movements in the betting markets were enough to trigger a flag on Sport Radar, and given the sums of money were quite small relative to the risk, you can draw your conclusions, I think.
And is the sport clean now, or do you think it's still going on? It's just been driven further underground.
The sport will be... No sport is truly clean. And actually, one of the really fascinating things that came across our interviews with pretty much all of our interviewees, both on and off record, was this is a constantly evolving thing. So one of the elements I found particularly interesting in this was Liang Wenbo learned from a previous match fixing. So there was a 2018 match fixing, and the WPBSA published this really full, thorough report explaining what the players did and how they got caught. And Liang Wenbo read this report and goes, "This is how I avoid getting caught." And so I'm sure there'll be more players who at some point will come along and read this report and go, "This is how we avoid getting caught." And I think Andrew could probably speak better than I can to instances in other games, in other sports where match fixing is rife. Because I think tennis or table tennis or one of them is one of the big ones.
Yeah. The FT put out a very good article around about this time last year, actually, in terms of the most suspicious patterns of betting. And table tennis was right up there. Tennis was also up there. It's a lot of these that there's kind of
it's easier, isn't it, with one player? If it's soccer, you probably have to persuade several of the players to, you know, join
it's exactly right.
Tennis or table tennis, it's just before we leave snooker, I'm just interested in this guy, another word I'll massacre. I'm so sorry, Lian Lengbao, who was, it seems, the mastermind of this, or at least the mastermind operating in Britain. What happened to him? Is he still allowed to operate, or did he face any consequences?
No. So Liang Wenbo, he was banned for life. I said earlier that kind of his career kind of really went off track. In 2021, he was charged and given community service for he was caught on CCTV dragging a woman across the floor in Sheffield City Centre. Yeah. He then went on to kind of put pressure on these young players and was very much the ringmaster in all of this, and his story is one where he was, I believe, 36 at the time when all this came out, and he'd had a really quite reasonable snooker career up until that point. Had won lots of money, enough money that you'd assume would set him up for life. But really, he kind of, in terms of figureheads for this story and who quite clearly the authorities spotted as being one of the worst perpetrators, it certainly was him, because he's now banned for life. And I believe he didn't even turn up for the hearings themselves.
I mean, I do feel slightly sorry for these younger players, though, because you say they got £3,000 or £4,000 or £6,000 when there are billions at stake. They're the ones taking the risk. They're young men. They probably don't speak much English. Maybe I'm making assumptions but you know, they're in a foreign country. They must have felt pretty isolated, I guess.
Yeah, absolutely. And Changbin Yu, where we start the podcast, we end our podcast talking about him as well, to bring that story full circle, because for someone like him, he missed that pink and lost the game 2-1. He returned to China. It's difficult to know what the future will hold for him, and his story is particularly tough, because actually in the investigation and in the hearing, they heard that he only had £100 in his bank account. When the investigation started, he was only 21 years old, had just moved to England, and then was kind of picked out by Liang Wenbo and the associates to kind of fix matches. So his is particularly tough. He can return to snooker. His ban was relatively short, so he can return to snooker next year in 2025. But it's just whether or not he kind of can muster the confidence and the will to get back to the level.
Well, he's on the wrong side of the Communist Party, you mentioned. You don't want to be on the wrong side of those guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting, sorry, just to go back to something that we were speaking about earlier in terms of whether or not snooker is clean. The authorities, after all this, did put some steps in place to try and limit and mitigate against this ever happening again. So, as I mentioned, Changbin Yu had £100 in his bank account. The authorities saw that the influence of literally only £3,000 or £4,000 was probably enough to make them change their entire career trajectory. So what they did last year was announce that they were going to give every professional player £20,000 just by having the tour card, essentially. So there's 130 professional players. They get £20,000, which doesn't sound like a lot, but for some of these players is enough to probably just go, right, outside of what I can earn in terms of winnings over the course of this year, it will just, you know, dissuade me from going down that particular route.
But perhaps, Phil, just because there's so much money at stake, the organisers will just pay them more, and it'll become, in some ways, it's just up to the level of corruption.
Yeah. And in a similar sense, because it's match fixing is always this world where who's ahead of each other? Are the match fixers ahead of the authorities, or are the authorities ahead of the fixers? The fixers could look at that and go, well, we can offer them more. If billions have been gambled in another country on the black market, well, this £3,000 that we're offering to this player, we could probably turn quite easily into £30,000.
I mean, do you think the authorities really want to deal with this issue? I mean, and can they?
That's a very, very good question. Because it brings in so much. I mean, this is match fixing's always been present in sport, but this feels like a particularly modern problem in that authorities are always going to struggle to keep up with because of the speed in which you can gamble due to betting platforms essentially running on milliseconds and that kind of thing, and because of how connected everyone is. It's hard to think that the problem won't go away, and therefore when it comes to what the authorities can actually do about it, it's a very, very difficult problem for them. I guess that, as with quite a lot of sports stories, when it comes to perhaps doping and other types of cheating in sport, the authorities, to me, it always feels like they just say to sporting regulators and authorities, you deal with that yourself, because these aren't proper crimes, for want of a better phrase, in terms of you can regulate this, you can ban players, you can punish them enough. Why should we need to get involved? But then there is certainly criminal element to a lot of cheating in sport. So I don't really know why the authorities wouldn't get involved.
Are there other sports involved? I mean, darts, for example? I mean, have you investigated other sports to see how widespread this is?
We haven't. Other sports will be affected by match fixing. There's absolutely no doubt about that. I think I'd be amazed at any professional sport where money is involved, where match fixing does not happen to a greater or lesser extent. Where and when those things happen, it will be. So, for example, Ivan Toney is a very good example of somebody who got caught for betting on his own.
This is a British soccer player.
Yes, sorry.
The glorious.
And a Premier League one, although he wasn't a Premier League player when this happened. A
glorious team of Brentford, just up the road from me. Go Bees! Sorry.
Not my favourite team in the world, I'm afraid to say. But whereas, I think, was it the National League where there was a huge match-fixing scandal? I don't know if Andrew remembers.
Was Tony done for match-fixing? Yeah. I didn't realise. Okay.
Yeah, the National League it was.
So, have you got files open then on this? I mean, are you sort of monitoring what goes on, or are you moved on to other investigations?
I mean, so with all investigations we do, we'll always keep track of what happens next and monitor for progress. Currently, with the snooker one, there was a slightly interesting moment last year where there was an Asian Open Championship, but I can't remember exactly what it was called, where some of the players who were involved in this match-fixing scandal were supposed to appear and play because it was a non-official event. But in the end, they didn't actually turn up. So we do continue to keep across these stories.
Gosh, well, I mean, it's been fascinating. Completely different culture for us.
Apart from lowering the average age of our guests, you've... I mean, we normally just talk to loads of old hacks like ourselves, so it's good to know that the future of investigative journalism is in good hands.
Yeah, we look forward to other investigations and other chats with you.
Yeah, and thank you very much for your shoulders. It's so interesting. I think maybe I'll put on my dreams of being a professional snooker player on hold.
Well, there's a new opportunity there.
Stick to mountain biking. All right, thanks, guys. See you
Bye.
Later.
Thank you, babe. Thank you so Cheers. Much.
Bye.
Well, a first for us, but not the last time that we come back to sport. Lots of scandals there.
Yeah. Olympics. I think the buying and selling of players in football and in other sports, actually, in cricket, Indian professional cricket, is a really interesting area to look at.
Are you a changed man?
Are you going to get into sport? Are you going to go down Fulham, maybe with Chris, with your rattle and your scarf?
Well, if Chris invites me, I'll go. My son's supported Chelsea. I used to go to Chelsea matches, so I'm not quite the old...
Don't mention that at Fulham, mate. Do not mention that at Fulham, or you'll be...
No, indeed.
The West London rivalry to end all rivalries. Good. Well, that was really interesting. We've probably exhausted people's patience with this extremely long episode. But next week is going to be another goodie, isn't it? Why don't you reveal what's happening?
I'm trying to remember what we're doing next Sunday. Is it Lady Colin Campbell?
It is, for her third time. We have enticed her back. She has a new book to talk about.
She's updated her Harry and Meghan book, and I think it's going to be even more critical than the previous books. And she's always good value, always has great insights and knowledge. So, and I think she's been our most popular podcaster so far, hasn't she? Up there with Valentine.
Up there with Valentine, definitely she has. And she's always very entertaining. I guess it's a really interesting time to talk about Harry because his court cases, there's so many, it's hard to keep up, but he seems to be making real progress on the hacking one, which we just mentioned earlier in the show. And I wonder,
yes.
I wonder what she has to say about that, because she is a critic. But there's at least one part of what Harry's up to that a lot of us do support, which is his great struggle to get to the bottom of what was going on in the British press with invasions of privacy.
Yes, no, I think he's got an important campaign that, and I think that may change public sympathies. You know, a bit like his father was sort of out of out of step with popular opinion at one point, and people have come round to him. I suspect people may come round to Harry.
Yes, I think, you know, now that we know that King Charles is seriously ill, you know, there's got to be a moment for a bit of a brotherly reconciliation. You'd have to think that. I'm not sure Lady Colley will agree, but we'll explore that next week.
Let's see. Yes, looking forward to it.
Indeed we are. All right. Thanks for listening and watching, everybody. Thanks. Bye.
See you next week. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Scandalmongers podcast. This has been a Podcast World production. You can get in contact with our show by emailing team@podcastworld.org, placing Scandalmongers in the heading, or via our social media links within the show's bio.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.